Second hour, Darren, Donick, and Chase here on ESPN 102.5 The Game on this Tuesday morning. Hope everybody's having a good day thus far. Exhibition games start today in the National Hockey League. The Penguins and the Flyers will get started at 3 o'clock our time. That game will be shown on NBC Sports Network. The Leafs and Canadiens after that on NHL Network, and the Oilers and Flames on NHL Network as well. So those are the three exhibition games that you can watch today. The Predators and Stars will be first up, and you will hear all the action right here on 102.5 The Game on Thursday. That has a 3 o'clock puck drop, and that will be you can watch that as well on Fox Sports Tennessee. Is that correct, Willie? No pregame?
No pregame.
No pregame. So 3 o'clock puck drop.
3 o'clock, Fox Sports Tennessee.
Thursday. Sean Shapiro covers
the
Dallas
Stars. In fact, I was just looking at our game plan of our meetings, and we're going to be doing some of that the next couple of days. In fact, I think Chase was part of it too. The NHL had a big conference call with the broadcasters explaining kind of the lay of the land of how they're going to send us the feed and everything like that. So it's coming. Exciting times.
Indeed it is. Let's learn about the opponent and how they're going into this return to play. Sean Shapiro covers the Stars for The Athletic, is on the line with us. Sean, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you guys doing today?
Did you ever think we would get to this point 4-plus months later?
I'll be honest. I was a little bit more pessimistic. Not that I didn't want it to return, but I was a little bit more pessimistic with how everything kind of shut down and everything. And so it's nice to it's nice to be talking hockey right now. I mean, it's one of those crazy things where it's funny we're going to see Dallas and Nashville start things up again, because I feel like so much of the 2020 season for Dallas has been defined about, you think about Dallas and Nashville going all the way back to, I mean, Winter Classic feels like 7 years ago now, but it's kind of fitting that these two teams are going to have played in both January and July somehow.
Isn't that crazy? You're right. The Winter Classic, which we were there, it does. It feels like it was another year. I mean, this is the same calendar year. It is hard to believe that that was just back on January 1. It feels like so long ago. So am I safe to assume you're in Dallas, you're not in Edmonton, or am I wrong?
No, yeah, you're safe to assume that I am in Dallas. We obviously, with how the NHL has decided to handle the media access, even if you do go to Alberta or Toronto, there's no in-person access available. And for me personally, I can do the same job from my living room, and
yep.
I can also not have to spend quarantine for 14 days and be away from the family when I really can't do my job more effectively there. So yeah, I'm still in Dallas. Got the living room. I got my home office with the TV set up. I've got my own coffee, and now I'm trying, during the day, I'm trying to run the toddler ragged tired so I can watch some hockey at 3 o'clock today with maybe during her nap time.
Outstanding. So we got a chance to do our show last week at Bridgestone Arena and the week before at Bridgestone Arena around the Predators training camp, and we kind of just took away our observations from what John Hines, head coach, was trying to do, and then getting them back, getting their legs back, getting them ramped up for what's about to take place in Edmonton. What did you observe with the Stars training camp?
Yeah, Dallas was really interesting, and I think this is something that maybe you saw a little bit with, you may have seen some of this with Nashville, where the Stars have a different coach than running training camp than they did back in September. So we got to see a Rick Bonus-led training camp. Obviously, Rick was here when it was an assistant and before the whole Jim Montgomery getting let go mid-season. But we got to see kind of the first training camp with Rick Bonus running things. And the thing we saw with the Stars, one of the biggest focuses, was how does this team squeeze out some more offense? They're not going to become a run-and-gun team or anything like that. But this team, obviously, you don't want to be the 27th-ranked offensive team in the NHL. You want to be scoring more than 2.61 goals per game. So it was a big focus on that, of how do we create more offensively? How do we kind of get more offensive juice out of everything? And one of the big things I think we'll see with the Stars, and if they are successful in that manner, and we saw a lot of it in camp, is can their defensemen activate more and be more of that fourth, act like a fourth forward on the rush, joining the play, consistently. We've seen it happen. The Stars have had some success with it through the year with John Klingberg and Miro Heiskanen, but the Stars want to give the green light more to all of their defensemen as we return to play, just as it's kind of, hey, chances there, join the rush. We want to get the numbers there. That's probably going to be the not a major change, but that's the change. The biggest change we'll probably see offensively. There'll be some tweaking, playing around line combinations, but at the end of the day, the Stars are a team that if they're going to go deep in this tournament and if they're going to have success, it's going to come back from that defensive identity where they're going to win some low scoring games, low event hockey, and they're going to be built off their defensive structure.
Something we talked about is just the approach of John Hines in this exhibition game and how he would handle the goaltenders. How would that play out? Because the Predators are in a different situation. They're going to start on Sunday, and it's going to count. Mm-hmm. Dallas is going into a round-robin situation where, yes, it counts for seeding, but if you lose, you're not going home. The Predators don't get it done. They're coming back home, so it's a different approach. How do you think Dallas is going to approach this exhibition game on Thursday, and how do you think their coaching staff will approach a round-robin tournament and not a qualifying round?
Well, I think one of the things that really fascinates me about these exhibition games, particularly like the ones between Dallas and Nashville, where one's going into a playoff series and one's going into a round robin, is the fact that I think the teams like Nashville, they're going to be the ones that get to set the tone more so for what this exhibition game is. Because I think while the coaches say, well, the Dallas coaching staff obviously wants to win, and that's the big message. Everything's important. But they know that their biggest thing to come out of that Thursday game is stay healthy, get both goalies some action, and be ready for that soft opening of a round robin. Nashville obviously needs to be ready to have their season on the line. So I think a team like Nashville, if Nashville wants to ratchet up the intensity, I think Dallas will match it. If Nashville treats it more like a typical preseason game, I think Dallas will match that intensity. I think there's more of an onus on that team that has their season on the line in 3-4 days after this game to set what this preseason game will look like. I think Dallas is going to be more so of, let's work on some special teams. Let's get Ben Bishop two periods of action. Let's get Anton Khudobin some action just in case. Let's get everyone healthy and just get the legs moving. But whether we win or lose, we know no matter what, on August 11th or 12th, whatever day it is, we have our real playoff starts then. So we're trying to win in the round robin, but the round robin is really about gearing up to be ready for that first real playoff game.
Talking to Sean Shapiro, he does an excellent job covering the Dallas Stars for The Athletic. I enjoyed, Sean, the scoop that you got. Apparently the Wi-Fi in the hotel needs a little work out in Edmonton.
Yeah. Yeah, it was one that's, if you watched the Stars Zoom availability yesterday, it wasn't much of a scoop. It's one where we had Tyler Seguin, Joe Pavelski, John Klingberg on, and then Stars interim coach Rick Bowness. And I think they gave some insightful answers, but I honestly don't know, because we asked questions via Zoom, and their response is we heard maybe every third word, and so I don't really know what they actually said. I mean, you could try to piece it together, but yeah, then doing some reaching out and talking and finding out some players in the bubble. One of the things that obviously these players are going into this bubble with plans to spend a long time there, and so you had a lot of guys bringing video game systems and computers and everything like that. And I know one of the first things many of the players did when they got into the Edmonton was try to hook up the Xbox, the PlayStation, whatever. And the internet speed was not nearly fast enough for what the level of gaming that these guys plan to try and play with friends at home or whatever it is, or even just play with other guys on the same internet in the same room. So, yeah, it is funny seeing that. And it's also funny seeing kind of, you listen around and it sounds like in Toronto, that's the one edge to the Toronto bubble so far, I guess, where the Wi-Fi's been humming along a little bit better in Toronto.
John, what do you think? I'm looking at your article with the line combinations, and mm-hmm. these two teams are so familiar with one another, going back to the playoffs last year and, you know, some high-profile games this past season. They got all four of their regular season matches. And I was actually just going through it myself. And, for example, as they sagged a bit at the end, right before the pause, I saw Alexander Radulov. I guess he got sick or got benched. Justin Dowling was in there. What do you think is the best way to deploy the top forwards for Dallas? What has worked the best for him, and how much do you think they might tinker with it during this time that they have?
Yeah, I think one of the big things for the Stars is figuring out, and I think it's one of the keys for the playoff run, is figuring out how do they get the best version of Joe Pavelski, because I think that's one of the things that one of the reasons Dallas went out and signed Joe Pavelski was they didn't score enough goals in the playoffs last year in that St. Louis series. They didn't score enough goals in general, and the Pavelski signing has not net the goals they expected. And so, for me, Ben Sagan-Radulov is one of the most exciting lines in hockey when all three are clicked, and I think that's something that you definitely need to keep in your back pocket. But I really like what they've been trying to do in getting Alexander Radulov and Joe Pavelski as a line there, getting them playing. And they played every day in training camp. They skated together yesterday. I imagine they'll skate together on Thursday in the exhibition game. Because Joe Pavelski is the type of player who needs a possession-style player who can draw attention away. And Joe Pavelski has made an entire career of being that poacher, being in the right spot at the right time and finishing. And obviously for a decade plus, he did it with Joe Thornton. And Stars don't have anyone like Joe Thornton, and you can't expect anyone to be like Joe Thornton. But I think Alexander Radulov is that type of possession player that can be chaotic and can run things and allow Pavelski to kind of slip through the cracks and get to those areas where he can score those big goals. So to me, that's kind of I like Ben and Sagan staying together. I like Pavelski and Radulov staying together. I think something you have to just figure out is who's the third forward for each of those lines as you kind of find the best fit.
We're talking to Sean Shapiro of The Athletic, and I want to go back to Rick Bowness for a second because you brought him up earlier in this interview. What is the future for him? Is he probably going to be the guy they're going to take the interim tag off? Does he want to be? Like, what does that look like moving forward for him?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because Rick is 65. He's the oldest head coach in the NHL. He has the interim tag. And it's one of those where when he signed on, and he told us this, he signed on, he woke up one morning, got told Jim Montgomery was getting fired for non-hockey reasons, and all of a sudden he's in charge, and he agreed to handle the ship till the end. And I think it's one of those things where Rick still has to decide, and if he has decided, he hasn't told us what his future wants to look like for himself. I don't know if he wants to be an NHL head coach. I don't know if he wants to go back to just – he's been very successful as an assistant, so I don't really know what Rick wants. That's one of the big parts. And then the other thing, and just kind of the timing of how all of this changes – The Stars are at a point where, with what the shutdown has done, is it's created such a small window before the 2021 season. You don't have a ton of time to, especially if the Stars go on a deep run, you don't have a ton of time to really change things and do a big coaching search. So I think the longer the Stars are in, if they win a round or two, or certainly if they win two, I think Rick Bowness is the head coach to start next year. And I don't think he's obviously 65. So as I said, I don't think he's the long-term solution where 3 years from now, Rick Bowness is the head coach, but he could have that title removed depending on how long this playoff run goes. And I think that's how Jim Neal will make his decision on whether he goes, am I going to do a big search or is Rick the guy? It's a really fascinating thing to play out because you typically don't have the interim tag for the reason the Stars have, and you hardly ever have an interim coach take over a team that is doing well like Dallas was.
Something that we've done with the Predators roster and kind of talked about is, okay, we know that this guy, maybe he gets off to a slower start than this guy, and that could be a concern with a five-game series that the Predators have. Now, a little different with Dallas, but is there a guy that you're concerned with that they know they're going to need him right away, but he typically has a slower start?
It's not as much of – I just look at what happened to start this season where – and it hasn't been historically that way, but you look at Dallas started this year, and once again, we talked about the Winter Classic feeling like years ago. This feels like even longer ago. Dallas had that one 7-1 start to start the year, and a big part of that was Jamie Benn and Tyler Seguin started off really slow, and I think that's one of the kind of concerns that for Dallas coming into this is, can Jamie Benn and Tyler Seguin come in and start strong? Was their performance in October, along with the rest of the teams, was that an anomaly? Is that something where we have to be concerned about them starting slow? I think that's really the big thing I circle is, what will Tyler Seguin and Jamie Benn be to start? Because I think they're on a potential positive standpoint. I think you guys saw with Nashville last year how effective Jamie Benn was in that series against the Predators. Well, he started to wear down against St. Louis, and he had the buildup of an 82-game season and wear and tear on him. Jamie Benn's got 4 months where he's been rested and healthy, and we could see the best version of Jamie Benn. I just don't know how quickly he can get going and get started. So to me, that's kind of the thing, is how quickly can those two biggest names get going? Because a lot of the other guys really feed off those two anyway.
Do you think that the Stars have gotten what they were looking for in a player like Corey Perry? And I know I don't mean what happened in the Winter Classic, but the physicality and what, you know, the pest that he can be. Preds fans are cringing right now, but have they gotten what they were looking for in bringing him in to add a little bit of that to this team?
Yes and no. I mean, it's something where Corey Perry had a real rough start to the season, then obviously he had the massive walk of shame in the Cotton Bowl, and so that's kind of defined his season, and it's definitely something that has not been the success that you would have hoped for with the name Corey Perry. But when you stop and you think that the Stars signed him on a low risk, high reward based off a incentive type deal, I think it's been exactly what you wanted for a forward that can move up and down the lineup, can be a little bit of a pest. Still has, we've seen some of those goal scoring moments. He still has that. The hands haven't gone away while the rest of the game may have slowed down. So it's the signing, the Corey Perry signing I've always looked at. It's the signing that Jim Neal went out and got thinking, I want that guy on my bench in the locker room when we're in double overtime in April. And I think that's still how this signing will ultimately be judged, because it's going to be what he does in the playoffs. But as far as the regular season goes, for the low risk, there wasn't much reward, but for what the risk was, it worked out for Dallas.
It's going to be a lot of fun. We're glad it's back. We'll get a taste of it today, tomorrow, and then, of course, Thursday when the Predators and Stars do their exhibition game. And then, hey, we got hockey sun up to sundown all weekend long. Sean, really appreciate the visit as always. Thanks for the info, and we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, it's been fun, guys. Have a good one.
All right, you too. Sean Shapiro covers the Stars for The Athletic and does a really good job. I was looking at one of his tweets, and it was pretty interesting, him putting out the average age. This is according to, I guess, the PR for the Stars, the average age of all the rosters, of all the teams, you know, that are at the hub cities.
Mm-hmm.
And so have you guys looked at this? Have you cheated?
I have not.
Or
nope.
Would you like to play along without cheating?
Let's play along.
Okay. Who is the oldest team? Who is the oldest team?
Are we doing this now or when we come back?
Yeah, no, right now. We're gonna talk for a little bit, and then we're gonna have Jessica Mendoza. We're gonna talk some baseball with her at the bottom of the hour. Who's the oldest team, average age of their roster? Oldest team in either Toronto or Edmonton. So these are the teams that are gonna be playing.
The Nashville Predators are right up there.
Yeah, that was gonna be my guess, and I have not cheated, but I know that they're one of the older teams. So I'll say them. I'll say the Preds.
That's what I will say too.
Okay. Interesting that you guys both said that. They are the second oldest team.
Ooh.
So, well done. But there's actually one team that's a little bit older by average age. It's an Eastern Conference team.
Yeah, okay. Eastern Conference.
In the East, the older team...
Montreal?
No, Montreal is one of the younger teams.
Pittsburgh Penguins.
The Pittsburgh Penguins are the third oldest team, so they are right behind Nashville.
Caps?
Capitals.
The Capitals are the sixth oldest team. So Preds, second oldest. Pittsburgh, Capitals are sixth. So you're missing the one, the four, and five.
The one, the four, and the five.
Well, because of Chara, it's probably
the
Bruins. I didn't think about him.
Actually, the Bruins are in the middle of the pack. I honestly thought you would say that early on, and I would have said that would have been a good guess because I would have said the same thing. They're in the middle of the pack.
I don't think it's Philadelphia.
Stunning.
Philadelphia is right around Boston. They're actually even younger than Boston.
Yeah, I would not have guessed.
Carolina?
He's got fairly. No, can't be.
Carolina is one of the younger teams. They're a little bit older than Montreal.
Man, you've stumped us.
I know. There's one obvious. None of these are really, but they're actually this one. I think I'm surprised you guys haven't thrown this one out there. I mean, it's a team year in and year out. They're always there. So
Tampa.
Yeah, Tampa. Tampa's the fourth oldest.
Tampa's older, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the fourth oldest.
So we still haven't named number one.
So you haven't named one or five.
Go, Willie.
We've guessed half the teams. All
right. One is Eastern Conference. Five is Predators Division.
Okay, so five might be the Blues.
No.
Winnipeg.
No.
The Dallas?
Team we just talked about, Dallas?
No.
Minnesota?
Wow.
You're going to get it eventually. Yes, it's Minnesota. The Minnesota Wild are the fifth oldest team.
Okay.
So you still haven't gotten the Eastern Conference oldest team in the return to play.
Islanders?
Barry Trotz and Company, the New York Islanders.
I was thinking
they got
about
a lot of veterans towards the bottom. Veterans towards the bottom of the lineup. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of ways, though, that you can scrutinize age. Like when you have Chara, he's going to skew it, right? So that shows you how young the rest of their roster is because, you know, they've still got Krejci and Bergeron and some guys that have been there for a long, long time. But they've got a lot of young players, too. So it's like the blend of the youth and the veterans is the key. So the Predators' core is more in their upper 20s now rather than the lower 20s. I think that's what puts them up there. Plus, you have guys like Dan Hamhuis and Pekka Rinne that are up, you know, in mid to high 30s, which brings that average up some, too.
They're the same age, right?
So 36, going on 37, something like that?
Yep.
Because I think their birthdays are close together.
All right, who's the youngest team?
Colorado?
No, nope.
That's a good one. Well, that was a good
Colorado's
guess.
Like closer to the middle. They're not middle of the pack. They're on the younger side, but they're probably eight teams away from
I guess as I think about it, they actually added some veterans from last year to this past year. This is good, Darren. This is a good exercise because it's working the rust off where we left off. Is Toronto among the youngest?
I would say Arizona.
How young their core is.
Toronto is the third youngest.
Okay, Arizona.
No, Phil Kessel's 49, so that pushes them way down. So they're actually one of the older teams. Or maybe he just looks old.
He kind of looks old.
He's not really that old. He just looks old.
Rangers?
The Rangers, you're on a roll. That's the second youngest team. So the Leafs are the third youngest team. The Rangers are the second youngest.
Is it Western?
You have not named the youngest.
Is it Western?
I'm not giving you any more hints.
Vancouver.
Good guess.
It's a good guess, but Vancouver is more on the older side.
Really?
Carolina.
Nope. I already told you.
Yeah.
Carolina was on the younger side, but they're not. They are just behind Colorado.
I don't know.
Youngest.
This is.
You haven't even mentioned this team yet.
You
haven't even guessed the team yet.
Edmonton?
Nope. Edmonton is on the younger side. They're right behind Carolina. So Colorado, Carolina, then Edmonton, then Montreal. Then Columbus, then Toronto, then the Rangers, and then this team that you've still yet to
Florida?
Even guess. Nope, middle of the pack.
Yeah, Florida sucks. It's middle of the pack.
Columbus?
Youngest.
I just told you Columbus is right after Toronto. So Columbus, Toronto, Rangers, and then the youngest team.
Columbus, Toronto, Rangers.
This is why this is fun, because I knew you were never going to get this. Because we have one thing in our head, because we've said it so many times. But it's actually not true.
You're going to say it's Chicago.
Yeah, because we always say, well, they look old, right?
There's no way.
How many times do we say, they look old and slow? Old
right.
and slow.
Well, yeah, and the guys that they have.
Remember,
they have a lot of young guys that they're
playing. They've had to dump because of the salary cap.
Chicago.
Chicago Blackhawks. Chicago, youngest team.
There Here we are racking our brains, and it's...
I knew you guys weren't going to get it.
Yeah.
All right, we will come back, talk a little baseball with Jessica Mendoza, ESPN. We'll do that on the other side. Darren, Donick, and Chase, ESPN, 102.5 The Game. Back here on Darren, Donick, and Chase on this Tuesday morning, ESPN, 102.5 The Game. Happy to say hello to Jessica Mendoza, who covers Major League Baseball for ESPN, does a great job on that platform, and certainly they have been in the news in the last 24, 48 hours. Jessica, how you doing?
It's been pretty crazy, I'm not going to lie.
You know, we expected to wake up Monday morning and do a four-hour sports talk show and talk about all the baseball games that we watched, and baseball is back, and recap everything, and we get hit with the Marlins story right out of the gates, and two postponement of games, and it's like, oh no, it just came back. It just started. How did we get to this point?
Yeah, I think that's what's crazy. I was in the same boat, like so pumped for opening day. We made it to the starting line, which, I mean, you think about even for the other professional sports, are they going to get there? And it was like, we did it. Over the weekend, it was almost like I kind of just got lost in all the games, and just Justin Verlander's got a forearm strain, just all the news coming in to that Monday, and then almost slapped awake of like, this is a pandemic, and it doesn't matter how beautiful baseball is to be back, it's not immune to anything that the rest of us are. And, you know, I just feel like right now the frustrating part is, you know, just still moving forward. Let's say another team outside of the Marlins has multiple cases, and, you know, according to a lot of infectious disease specialists, once you get 3+, it's already an outbreak. And that Sunday morning, to me, was the most pivotal moment when the Marlins had a total of 4 positive tests of COVID-19 and then made the decision to still play that day against the Phillies. Now, those 4 players obviously did not play, but just knowing that it went from 1 to 4 in the span of 48 hours, and it was left up to the team to make the decision to play or not. And of course, and you think about it, like if I'm a player and I'm 20, 21 years old, I want to play. Get me out there. And by the very next morning, there was a total of 11.
Yeah, I could sense your frustration. I certainly don't want to put words in your mouth. I want you to tell us and our audience exactly how you feel. But I could sense your frustration this morning on some of the ESPN platforms. I guess it was probably Get Up, the one that I saw you talking about, you know, Rob Manfred, and you just felt frustrated that, because like what you said, as a player, your players want to play. That's what they do. So you can't really ask them. That's what they're going to do. It's like, do you want to play today? And anything, forget a pandemic. They're going to say, of course. Yeah, but we're playing a doubleheader, but put me in. I'll play both games. I don't care. That's a player's mentality. But you seem frustrated by maybe the lack of planning, because we sat here on this show on all these sports coming back, Jessica, going, it's not if, it's when. So what is the plan when this happens? It's inevitable. It is going to happen when you return to play. How do you handle it? So that's where I think I sensed your frustration. Is that right? Where that doesn't seem like they kind of had the plan for this, something like this happening?
Well, and I mean, there's going to be so many of those sentences. Like, we didn't plan on this happening. I mean, that's kind of 2020 in a nutshell, right? But I can even understand Sunday happening, but then the response, I feel like, is you got to remember there's 113 pages of protocols that have been incredibly thorough as to what teams need to do to be able to keep their players safe, to keep their staff safe. And within those 113 pages, there isn't anything that talks about, okay, once you have multiple positive tests, beyond just isolating those players, what you do as a team, there's nothing in there as far as a decision. And once Sunday happened to Monday, now you've got 14 total, 11 players, 3 staff members within the Marlins organization. Then you adapt. Then you change. Then you add. I mean, you don't just go by, you know what, these are our protocols. That was my frustration. It was like, you know what, this is going to happen. It's a pandemic. We've got protocols in place. Carry on. And I was floored because in my opinion, and, you know, I feel like so many players feel this way, is, you know, even Davey Martinez, the manager of the Nationals, we've heard so many people with the fear now of like, okay, carry on. Like, no one wants baseball to stop, and I'm not saying eliminate baseball at this point, but I think you need to add some protocols of what teams need to do once they have more than one positive case.
Yeah, as you can imagine, we've gotten to know David Price pretty well over the years, pitching at Vanderbilt and being a Nashvillian growing up here. And so we've had a lot of talks with him. He was pretty vocal on Twitter, on social media yesterday about player safety. Of course, we know he has opted out for this season. What did you make of his tweet?
You know, I mean, I think David's on one end of the spectrum, and I think his voice is important because he did decide to opt out. I know that was a very hard decision that he had to make for him and his family, but also at the same time, he's got a front row seat sitting back and watching all this without playing. So I think it's hard when you're in it, right? And you're on your team, you've got all your goals, you're working on, you know, like my pitches, my hitting, like all those things. He's sitting there watching these games from afar going, okay, like, why is there not more for the safety of the players? And really, he called out Commissioner Manfred in that tweet in a very, you know, hard way. And I think he represents a lot of players that have fear right now and that probably don't have the luxury that David has of opting out. I mean, you think about David Price and the amount of money that he's made in his career, will continue to make. He's the top 1%, right? There's a ton of players out there, and this is a reminder that they don't really have the option to not play. Them opting out means they don't get any money this year. And I think like anybody that's trying to make a living, that has a family, you're weighing that decision amongst all that. I had a conversation with Frankie Montas last week, who's the opening day starting pitcher for the Oakland A's. And his wife is pregnant and due in September, their baby girl. And he talked about how difficult the decision was for him. But at the end of the day, for someone like him, he's got to make – he wants to provide for his family. So it's like you want to provide, but you also want to be safe. And the fact that those are at a crossroads is really sad.
Talking to Jessica Mendoza from ESPN, baseball analyst. And so, Jessica, I don't know if we've heard a lot of details or if we're going to hear a lot of details on what they could find out on how it spread – in the Marlins clubhouse, but what can be learned for other, because it could be a really good teachable moment early in this process here where you still have so much to go for teams to say, okay, this is how it happened. Either X was being irresponsible or, hey, it could happen to anybody, even if we're trying to do the right things here. What do you think we'll learn about what happened here as to what caused such an outbreak?
You know, I think just how quickly it can spread within one team, clearly, but I think the biggest, all eyes right now have been in Philadelphia and if any of the Phillies players, and not just the first initial test that I think they were getting back last night and early this morning, if even all of those come back negative, there's an incubation period, and I think that was the Yankees' concern. So you're seeing all the different teams, right, the trickle effects. And the Yankees, they postponed that game. The Yankees are like, I don't want to go in that clubhouse. Are you kidding me? You've got 14 members of one team that were here 24 hours ago and you want us to be in here? No way. But now I think the real question is if this can spread team to team. Now we're talking about something incredibly serious. I mean, I'm hoping, obviously, like everyone, it doesn't, just because that's the beauty of baseball, compared to sports like the NFL and the NBA is it's not a contact sport. You have that natural social distance built within the sport. So even though there were all those members of the Marlins that had the virus while they were playing the game on Sunday that we now know of, if there's still a really good chance, I hope the Phillies didn't get it. But if they did, to me, it's like this can't be played. Like baseball cannot be played if it's being transmitted team to team that easily.
And it's very difficult, too. I'm trying to figure out myself how quickly the tests can be turned around. I see Bob Nightingale has been putting out a series of tweets today regarding Juan Soto, who apparently has tested negative a number of times since he got the positive test, which apparently, according to Nightingale, was July 23rd. So what do you understand? I mean, we're all learning about this, Jessica. We want to talk baseball, right? We just want to watch the games. But learning how quickly they can get the tests and what you have to do to get through it if you have tested positive is a very important part of this equation.
Yeah, and I mean, we're still seeing that system figure itself out as well. We saw during summer camp or spring training 2.0 just a couple weeks ago, a lot of the tests being delayed, results not coming back as soon as teams needed them to be able to get back on the field. So we saw delays in teams even being able to practice or play games. And, you know, there's always a chance of a false positive, which is something that Juan Soto, I think, of the Nationals were hoping maybe his was. That's why they're consistently getting him more tests, because you have to have two negative tests to be able to return to play. But, I mean, again, like the uncertainty is such a high right now, but there's this frantic feeling of getting players back on the field and getting back to these games. And, you know, Jeff Passan actually just reported recently the Washington Nationals players just voted against going to Miami this weekend. So they've already said, we don't want to play. So this is already starting to spread amongst, you know, as far as the fear, not the virus itself, but the fear has now reached the Nationals and them telling Major League Baseball, we are not going to play in Miami this weekend. And so it'll be interesting to see how Major League Baseball responds to that, because this is a trickle effect that just keeps on going.
We're talking with Jessica Mendoza of ESPN, talking some baseball with her. So let's actually talk about some baseball on the field, because we're 4 days in to a young season, and still, as we've been talking about, a lot of unknowns. But with what you've seen so far, knowing the DH in the National League, the runner on second with extra innings, we've seen that come into play. What have you thought about the product so far to start the 60-game season?
You know, I've loved it. I mean, just the fact that it just has this feeling of being such a unique year. You know, the runner at second base, the first game I did on Friday with the Angels and the A's was actually the first game to implement that when we got to the 10th inning. I played with that rule for 15 years in the Olympic Games and internationally, so I'm super familiar with it. I've always liked it just because it gets offense going. I've always felt like no one wants a five-hour game when you see just kind of a stalemate of a zero, you know, tie score. So I like that. The Universal DH is just fun, again, I think, to trigger some more offense even within the National League. We'll see how these rules get implemented or continue to stay, if at all, you know, in seasons to come. But let's be real. I mean, I'm looking at Giancarlo Stanton and the weekend he had with the Yankees, and you just start to get excited about, because it's only 60 games, some of the records, some of the numbers, some of the things that we can see in a limited amount of time. And, you know, I talked to Jeff McNeil, the Mets, even last week about hitting 400. I mean, there's, you know, just fun things that, yes, like, put the pandemic aside, everything we just talked about for the first 15 minutes of this show, right? And there's baseball in a very unique way that I think a lot of people are excited to see in a way they probably wouldn't have been as excited for regular season MLB.
At what point, you know, usually in a regular season, four games in, you're not even thinking past the next weekend. I mean, you can't really take anything away from a record. But at what point will a team that, you know, currently right now might be 1-3, like the Reds, or a team like the Rays that played against Atlanta last night, they're 3-1. At what point do you start to go, okay, yep, they're for real, they're in trouble?
I think 2 weeks. 2 weeks is kind of the mark I looked at, because that's like, this is crazy. That's a quarter of the season.
I know.
Think about that. I mean, so at 2 weeks, which, I mean, it's mind blowing because we're almost at a week now. you know, coming this Thursday and Friday. And then just a week after that, in my opinion, I'm starting to look at records. I'm starting to look at numbers. I'm starting to look at standings in a way that's significant. That's what makes this so unique, because even in 2 months of a regular 162 games, I'm not really taking those numbers as seriously. Look at the Nationals, and we've heard it time and time again, 19 and 31 through those first 60 games. They were, their manager was getting fired. They were the worst team in baseball. They end up winning it all, right? So that's why through first 60 games in any other year's past, first 2 months, you're not even paying attention as far as, like, is this really significant? Right now in 2 weeks, that can actually dictate where we're going to be for the next. And it's like, buckle up. Here we go.
And I know this is, you know, you look at things from more of a national level, but with the Braves, what do you think went wrong with Mike Foltynewicz as they've designated him for assignment after one game plus what we saw in the playoffs and last season?
Well, listening to Ryan Snicker talk about just the stuff. I mean, he's known for the velocity. He's known. I mean, just watch how his fastball especially takes off. It reminds me actually a little bit of what I saw, we all saw in Shohei Ohtani this past Sunday, who couldn't even get an out. So, you know, you don't know what's going on inside and, you know, anything else. But I think the fact that there's something significantly different with the arm, you know, and it doesn't seem to be any kind of injury related, just more of like letting it fly the way that we've seen him be able to do in the past, especially. I mean, gosh, he's had some of the best stuff that we've seen in the game. Lucky for the Braves, although they've got, you know, a few pitchers down right now, but, you know, being able to see, you know, guys like Mike Soroka go out there and just completely dominate base and their offense and how amazing it has been with all of their stars. But there's been some pitchers, not only with injuries, I mean, that's what blows me away, is all the Tommy Johns, the stars that we've lost, but also the Shohei Ohtanis that you're just so excited to see what they're going to have. And then it's like, wow, like 4 or 5 miles an hour less than what they normally have. I mean, in Ohtani's case, not being able to get an out in that first inning, it's pretty crazy.
Well, hopefully one day we're talking to you, Jessica, about the Nashville Stars, not just stars of Major League Baseball, but the Nashville Stars.
Right?
Hopefully, one day. Soon. Maybe in the next 4 or 5 years, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that I absolutely want to see. I've had the opportunity to play in Nashville numerous times. There was actually a pro softball team there that played out of Lipscomb. And oh my gosh, it was one of my favorite places, from the fans, but also the community. Because it's got that, you know, it's a bigger city, yet it has a small town feel, which I think for baseball is exactly what you want. And let's be real, that part of the country.
Yeah.
Like this entire space, you know, you've got Atlanta, but then you go anywhere west and it's like there's just not this representation of, you know, of baseball. And especially with Vanderbilt and Tim Corbin and what he's done at the college level within that area, there's just an igniting of passion for really great baseball. So I look to Nashville, and that's somewhere I would love to see. A baseball, Portland. I'm actually up here in Oregon, and Portland is another, they're working on their diamond project. They've already gotten approved. I mean, they're ready to go as well. They're just waiting on Rob Manfred to be able to add a couple more teams.
Wow, that sounds great. Hey, thanks for the visit. Really appreciate it. Good talking to you, and we'd love to talk to you down the road.
Yeah, I love me some Nashville. I miss it out there. Can't wait to travel again so I can get back.
All right. Continue to be safe. Jessica Mendoza, great job covering Major League Baseball there on ESPN. We will step away quickly, come back, and wrap up the second hour next. Good stuff this hour on Darren Donick and Chase. Learned a little bit more about the Dallas Stars. It'll be the Preds and Dallas on Thursday. So keep that in mind. At 3 o'clock puck drop, I'll have pregame for you at 2 o'clock right here on these airwaves. The minute Darren Donick and Chase show ends, we'll go straight into Predators pregame. So that'll be on Thursday. And then you just heard Jessica Mendoza, really good MLB talk with her. And it's pretty interesting. The part that I really perked up on is the Nationals supposed to go to Miami this weekend, and they told Major League Baseball, yeah, we're not going to Miami. So let's probably come up with another solution.
Can they Can they opt not to go? Like, what happens?
I don't know.
Do they have to forfeit? I mean, can the commissioner say, well, you have to go, or else it's a forfeit? I don't know.
Or can they move the game? Can they agree?
That's what I'm thinking.
I think that's what they'll do. You know, find.
But there's only so many games you can move. I did think about that. Is can baseball, if they need to, and maybe this is the smart way to go, pad the end of the regular season by a few days for makeup games and just start the playoffs a little bit later, even though they don't want to.
Right.
And I know the TV window is only a certain amount of time, and now they've expanded the playoffs, right? So there's more teams that make it. There's more playoff games that are going to have to be played. So there's only so much time. Or the other option is just going to have to be some teams play less games than others. You
but
know,
that's
it's
not
a
60
game season, but maybe some teams end up only playing 58 games.
When I say move the game, I mean physically move the game. So just say, and this is an opportunity for a place like Nashville. They say, okay, if you're not comfortable playing in Miami, if you're not comfortable being there, and I understand that half the team is tested positive, but you find the players that you know are clean and they're good, and you say, okay, we would be willing to allow you to play at a neutral site, and you play at a neutral site. You're not having to worry about fans.
Does that make the Nationals feel anything? Because to me, I don't know what their fear is. Their fear, I mean, Miami was in Philly, so what is their fear of going to Marlins Park or whatever the heck it's called? Is it going to Miami?
Or being around the players.
Or is it being around the players? If it's about being around the players, then it doesn't matter where they play it. You know, I don't know what their concerns are.
That's why I come back to, because the initial mistake was made by the Marlins by just saying, yeah, we got a couple positive tests, but we're
four
to
be exact.
We want to play.
Four.
Right. We want to play. We're just going to go ahead and play. Right? That was the mistake. They probably should have nipped it in the bud right there, and that makes you wonder, who was in charge of the Marlins? When did they first find out? Could they have done a better job of avoiding a spread within their clubhouse? But as to what, I mean, what's happened has happened. So there has to be, as Jessica was saying, there's got to be some protocols here in place of what happens if X, and this is X.
Well, that's
so the commissioner has to,
the
commissioner has to be able to say, you have to trust us. Yeah, you have to trust us that we're going to make sure that there's an environment created that we can play a game. And I say you can play in Miami, so you guys have to go to Miami. I mean, somebody's going to have to make that call. You can't just have teams decide whether or not they want to make a road trip just because they don't feel free. It's a league.
But how do you not have – how do you have a 113-page document and you don't have these type of things in there? I mean, I don't understand that.
Why is that?
Because they're worried about the labor negotiation.
Well, right, exactly.
They didn't take the time to go through these things. It looks apparent to me.
They couldn't get a deal done. It had to be the commissioner saying, well, okay, I have the power to you know, make the season happen at 60 games, so that's what we're going to do. They couldn't agree on anything, so that shouldn't surprise you that they have this 113-page document that they quote-unquote agreed on, but They couldn't get on the same page from the very beginning. So the fact that something fell through the cracks and they didn't have it in there doesn't surprise me at all. And so, yeah, then you have a team getting together and, hey, we're going to have a clubhouse vote. Nope, we don't want to go to Miami. So now what do you do? None of this shocks me. And that shows you just how off base they are with each other and how they're not on the same page. And quite frankly, Rob Manfred continues to look weak at his position through this whole thing.
He is going to be tested, and that is what happens. Weak leadership can get exposed in a crisis, so he is going to have to really earn his keep here. And you know, I find it also sort of ironic. You've got Washington saying, well, we don't want to go to Miami. Meanwhile, you've got this report. Bob Nightingale's got some really interesting tweets here saying Juan Soto's last positive test was July 23rd. So that's a good, you know, he's tested negative a number of times since then. So what's going on there? Like that's another thing is, at the end of the day, the players, the coaches, the teams have to trust the testing system, right? But I think there's more questions coming up with these tests. Like, how quick can you get them? Who's administering them? Because according to Nightingale, he's passed some tests given by the league and by the team, right? The team has the ability to test their own players too. So when does Juan Soto get the green light? Can you imagine let's put it in the Titans' perspective, right? Let's say the Titans have a key player, a starter. I mean, you can, in your own mind, make up who that would be. He had to miss a game because he tested positive. Now he's sitting there clamoring, I've tested negative since then. I'm ready to play, but doesn't get the clearance to play. Can you imagine the frustration on the part of the fans, on the part of the team, and, of course, the player, if that situation arises? I can imagine Juan Soto is going nuts. You know, it's only a 60-game season. He wants to get back out there. He feels like he's clear, feels good, ready to play.
We'll come back third hour. Mike Sando from The Athletic will tell you about the article he just wrote, and we'll certainly discuss that in the third hour of Darren Donick and Chase. That's next.